Did you know it's National Poetry Month? So let's celebrate James Dickey. James Dickey is probably best known for his novel Deliverance, which tells the story of a harrowing weekend canoe trip down a wild Georgia river, really a trip down a rabbit hole into a world of backwoods horrors. It was made into the hit movie starring Burt Reynolds in 1972.
Machines are going to fail. And the system's going to fail.
And then what?
Then survival. Who has the ability to survive? That's the game. Survive.
But before and after Deliverance, James Dickey was also a poet, regarded as one of the finest of his generation, his words often taking readers down frightening rabbit holes. He was poetry consultant to the Library of Congress before there was a poet laureate. He won a National Book Award in 1966. In 1977, he read his poem, The Strength of the Fields, at President Jimmy Carter's inaugural gala.
My life belongs to the world. I will do what I can.
James Dickey died in 1997, and now a new book, The Complete Poems of James Dickey, collects the 331 he published during his lifetime, and we want to spend a Friday on poetry with his son, Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, author in his own right of several books, including Summer of Deliverance, a memoir about his often troubled relationship with his dad. And Chris joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Robin. Always a pleasure.
And I just wonder, as we said, troubled relationship with your dad. What's it like for you to flip through these poems?
You know, it's a great experience. I've read my father's work again and again, and I heard him read it all the time I was growing up, either in formal readings or just around the house. And it brings back the best of what my father represented. He really was a poet first and foremost, and he had a vision of poetry that he felt could bring you closer to some sort of transcendental experience. And a lot of these poems do, I have to say.
Let's take a look at one. Buck Dancer's Choice. The narrator listens as his mother, who's dying of emphysema in the next room, whistles an old fiddle tune. It is called Buck Dancer's Choice. For years they have all been dying out, the classic buck and wingmen of traveling minstrel shows. With them also an old woman was dying of breathless angina, yet still found breath enough to whistle up in my head a sight like a one-man band. Is there something autobiographical there?
There is quite a lot that's autobiographical. My grandmother, my father's mother, did have angina, although she lived to be into her late 80s. She rested every day in the dark in the afternoon, and nobody was supposed to make any noise in the house, although the grandchildren could, and we often did, and we'd often join her in her big bed. But for my father, I think it was a kind of a disturbing feeling because it made her close but distant at the same time. And the way he uses this idea of the music of Buck Dancer's Choice is a beautiful kind of evocation of the strangeness of that experience and also a sense of the past blended with the present. It was the title of one of his small collections of poems, and it was that collection that won him the National Book Award.
Right.
And I think that poem gives you some idea why.
This idea, though, that his mother at the time is whistling an old fiddle tune, Buck Dancer's Choice, which, you know, in a way takes us back to Deliverance. Was that a world that you knew, that, you know, the fiddle tunes?
Not really. You know, my father identified with North Georgia. That is where, as he would put it, his people were from. But the truth is he was born and raised in Atlanta, which was this island of cosmopolitan existence in a pretty raw southern environment, which is a lot of where Deliverance came from, this idea that you were in an environment where the characters in Deliverance, one of them, for instance, is in advertising, another, I think, is in insurance. They go out into the wilderness that really isn't very far away, and they're in another world. And that is the world of the hillbillies, the bad guys in Deliverance, but it's also the world of the buck dancers. It's the world of that kind of buck and wing country music.
Yeah. By the way, you worked on that film when you were 19, and it is that collision of the city guys who go for this canoe trip and then just beyond the kudzu, you know, it feels like they're suddenly in this dark, frightening world they don't know how to function in. What did you think about this film? Your father wrote it.
Well, it was a pretty tense time, to tell you the truth. On the set of Deliverance, it was filmed chronologically, unlike most movies. So there was a buildup of tension toward the famous climactic rape scene in the movie, which is sort of the turning point in the film. By that time, people in the neighborhood had gotten an idea of what we were doing and what the film was about, and a lot of them didn't take too kindly to it. So there began to be a sense of risk on the set. And there was also a lot of machismo game playing on the set. Burt Reynolds, John Voight, the director John Borman, my father was eventually banned from the set.
Really?
All this
Why?
Sort of
Why?
Male psychological game playing. He saw this as his movie. And needless to say, the director saw it as his movie. And that was not a question that could be easily resolved. And my father was talking to the actors about his ideas for the way they should play their roles, which were pretty good ideas, but he didn't know anything about working with actors. And Burt Reynolds particularly really didn't like it. So finally, Borman asked my father to leave, but at the end of the day, he asked my father to come back and play the sheriff at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. So if you see the movie, and I think an awful lot of people have seen the movie over the years, and you see the sheriff lean into the car and tell John Voight, "Don't you boys do nothing like this again." That's pretty much what Dad would say to me when I would get home when I was 16, 17, and it was real late at night.
And by the way, you also played a corpse in the movie, we understand, but you were on the cutting room
yes,
floor.
Yes, but they cut my scene. Right. They cut right. my scene.
Right. But I guess what I mean is, you know, you mentioned the male rape, the murder, the descent, and the machismo on the set, the testosterone in the movie. Your father wrote this. It's one thing for all of us to watch it and think, who thinks of that kind of darkness? It's the other thing to know it's your dad.
Well, that's a good point, Robin. But I did grow up with it. And, you know, when you're a kid, you grow up thinking normal is what's around you. And that machismo, sure, it was a part of my father. But he was really interested in the idea of nature in the sense that there was something in nature that you could become, that you shouldn't deny and that you should embrace, and that in many of his poems, people are transformed, at least in their imagination, they're transformed into animals, or they relate to beasts in a zoo or a wolverine in the wild. That poetry of ecstatic transformation really has a kind of a beauty to it, which is very much part of the novel Deliverance, but is really kind of lost in the movie. In the novel Deliverance, the rape scene is important as a pivotal act, but it's not the main thing you remember from the novel. The main thing you remember from the novel is a climb up a cliff, which is also briefly in the movie, but that climb up the cliff is a kind of a bonding experience with the mountain, with nature, with the primal business of killing or being killed. That's really a sort of a different tone and weight in the book than it is in the novel.
Yeah. Chris Dickey, Paris bureau chief for the Daily Beast and Newsweek, talking about his dad, James Dickey, who, yes, wrote Deliverance, but also beautiful poetry. We're going to hear more, but you know we had to play this. Here is the music that became such a cheery jingle on radio and was so scary in the film. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Chris Dickey, Paris bureau chief for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, talking about his father, the late James Dickey, and the new collection of James Dickey's poems. Let's listen to a reading, and it's James Dickey reading from one, For the Last Wolverine.
I take you as you are and make of you what I will, skunk bear, cockajew, bloodthirsty non-survivor. Lord, let me die, but not die out.
So, Chris Dickey, we've talked about your father's connection to nature. He also writes about war, and one of his most famous poems is The Firebombing. This is an American pilot reflecting on a bombing raid over Japan. Is that him?
That is him. Mm-hmm. And the emotion that he's trying to deal with in that poem is, I think, a really interesting emotion for us to look at now in terms of modern warfare. My father was the ordnance officer and the navigator in Black Widow night fighters, flying over Japan toward the end of the war. He was part of these enormous firebombing raids. Of course, many of the Japanese cities then were built of wood and paper, and they would just go up in flames and turn people into dust. And it was really horrific. And he knew this, but from where he saw it, several thousand feet in the air, it was just this beautiful play of light and dark on the ground beneath him. The poem is about a man standing in his front yard in suburban Atlanta, 10 years after the events, trying to figure out how he feels about all that. That combination of beauty and war and guilt that he knows he should feel but knows he doesn't feel. And I think in this, the great age of drone warfare, it raises some very interesting questions. I actually, frankly, as somebody who covers a lot of wars, I don't think there is a better poem about the war and the kinds of wars we're fighting now than that war, the firebombing, about World War II.
Here's a section that might apply to what you just said. And some technical-minded stranger with my hands is sitting in a glass treasure hole of blue light, having potential fire under the undeodorized arms of his wings.
Yeah. Sure, the smell of napalm.
Yeah. You raise a question, Chris Dickey, because you are a reporter and you do cover war and you do write. You did have a difficult relationship with your father. You write about it in your memoir. You say he began lying. He began to make himself up and me, meaning you, too. Mm. You and your father and your mother both sank into alcoholism. But how much of your father are you?
Oh, I don't know. That's a scary thought.
Well, but the writing and the...
The truth is the reaction to the way he was made me really very literal-minded. I mean, he was a poet who believed strongly that you could invent a reality that was better and more interesting than the reality that existed around you. And I became very literal-minded and a reporter who thought that the reality I discovered around me was much more interesting than anything that I could really invent. And that was, philosophically, a divide between us. The real divisions between us had to do with my mother's slow death from alcoholism, blaming my father, a lot of things that I write about in the memoir. But on the other hand, my father and I were reconciled in the last two or three years of his life. And I remember after he died, going down to take care of all kinds of details and lying in his bed. He was a semi-invalid throughout that period. And he always had stacks and stacks of books around him. And the stacks of books that he had around him in his bed were all books about things that, you know, I was writing about. So he was trying to understand.
Oh. Were you seeing that he maybe cared more about you than you thought?
I was seeing that he was trying hard to understand what I did. So I tried hard to understand what he did. I think we pretty much came to do that by the end of his life.
Yeah. Well, we were going to take a look at some more poetry.
I think I can get through it.
It's hard. You know, it's hard. You know, we all have those shards that pierce us, but they're mostly memory. You have these lines. And let's look at some others. Maybe your dad's most famous poem is Cherry Log Road. A young man in a romantic rendezvous, waiting for a girl in a graveyard of old cars. Who hasn't been there? You know.
But he's waiting for a girl in the graveyard of old cars, and he's afraid that her father's going to show up with string-triggered shotgun and blow him away.
Well, it's off Highway 106 at Cherry Log Road. I entered the 34 Ford without wheels, smothered in kudzu, with a seat pulled out to run corn whiskey down from the hills. She does come. Do you have that ending there?
Oh, yeah, and she comes, and they make love in the car among the snakes and the vines. And then we left by separate doors into the changed other bodies of cars. She down Cherry Log Road, and I to my motorcycle parked like the soul of the junkyard restored, a bicycle fleshed with power, and tore off up Highway 106, continually drunk on the wind in my mouth, ringing the handlebar for speed, wild to be wreckage forever.
Wild to be wreckage forever. Do you understand more about that drive of your father's?
Yeah. My father came to believe that you could be a god, that you could, through poetry, through language, get in touch with experience and understanding of experience that you could not approach any other way. And he really did think that poetry was the finest calling of a man or a woman. And his best poems reflect that, a kind of experience of nature that isn't just about liking nature or respecting nature, but wanting to make it part of you and you part of it.
That's Chris Dickey, Paris bureau chief for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, but he's been talking to us about his father, James Dickey. His complete poems have just been released. And Chris, you mentioned the pull of the wild for your dad, but it was also the pull of the South and of youth, and maybe of a South that I don't know if it exists anymore. And so I thought we'd just end with his talking about his childhood friends in the poem Looking for the Buckhead Boys.
Mm.
Here is James Dickey reading from that poem in 1969.
If I can find them, even one, I'm home. And if I can find him, catch him, in or around Buckhead, I'll never die. It's likely my youth will walk inside me like a king.
Chris Dickey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this is the song, Buck Dancer's Choice, David Bromberg. And at herenow.org, some great pictures that Chris gave us. Check those out. Take a break. Latest news is next. Here and Now.